Blog Talk Radio.
And we're back.
We're back.
You
calling everybody
be able
on
to
the
hear
board here.
Now.
Hopefully you can hear. Let us know if you can't. So we were just in the discussing the spirit of truth. And oh, by the way, everyone, happy St. Patrick's Day. It's St. Patty's Day, so it's a great celebration of an Irish priest who really made all the difference in Ireland. I mean, he brought the Christian faith largely, you know, I wouldn't say single-handedly, but he really ignited the Christian faith on the Emerald Isle. So here's to St. Patty. We're speaking now. Yeah, here. Have a green beer and enjoy the day, wherever you are. We're speaking of the spirit of truth, and at Pentecost, right after Jesus ascended, he made 19 appearances, which we've talked quite a bit about on the show in the last few weeks. And right after he ascended, He told his believers that he would be sending a gift to them, that he and his Father would be pouring out the Spirit of Truth. And the promised helper was one way that he described it. And the book is very, intriguing in the things that it says about the promised helper. For instance, it says that when the Spirit of Truth was poured out and these wonderful men and women who followed Jesus and loved Jesus received this gift, they became exponentially more adept at sharing the gospel and at sharing his teachings than they ever were before when he was alive. And the things that they accomplished and the things that they learned and the things that they understood were by far better than before when he was alive and before he had poured out his Spirit of Truth. So there's something about that permeating spirit. And we've talked about it in group quite a bit, how we really don't know what it feels like to not have it. And that's something that intrigues me, thinking about that. What does it feel like to not have that Spirit of Truth? And, like that lady told me, and all those years ago, you know the ability to know the truth. You have the ability to know the truth when you hear it. What's it like to not have that? we will never know.
You know. I was thinking. Sorry to cut you off, Paula, but
no,
it just kind of dawned on me as I reflect that Jesus here walked with us, knows what humans go through, and then you're talking about how, what does it feel like to not have the Spirit of Truth? And I thought, you know, what a privilege it is. And of course, Jesus would have equality of all his children and God's children, that we would all have this opportunity of truth. You know the truth and the truth shall set you free. So all his children shall have this Spirit of Truth. And I guess maybe what an example might feel like is like maybe how we look in our common society now is that individuals who grow up with loving, supportive families have this innate privilege that they never quite can empathize with what it's like to feel completely abandoned growing up. And we have that privilege. We have this, in a spiritual and mental sense, we have this truth, the Comforter, the Holy Comforter, you know. And Jesus left it for us because he knew how lonely we might be over here. But we all have it equally. The true equality that we all have is this truth. And so what a blessing, what a gift. But I would say that one example might be that separation of that privilege of having supportive, loving family versus having a more challenging go at this life.
I love that, Derek. I love that analogy that he knew we'd be lonely, you know, because we are isolated. We are lonely. And one of the things that he was fighting against with us and that we need to fight against probably every day of our lives is this sense of cosmic orphanhood, you know, this sense that we're orphans, that you know, we're alone in the universe, that, you know, I mean, it's what makes it so compelling when we contemplate visitors from other worlds or anything like that. You know, it just reminds us that we're not alone. Anything that reminds us that we're not alone is very compelling.
It makes me wonder what the true potentials of the Spirit of Truth are, because Jesus, knowing how abandoned his children on a material level can be potentially on this planet,
and
as we've seen, and that this is the remedy for it. So there's a lot of potential value in the Spirit of Truth for individuals, even if they do feel abandoned.
Well, this paper, as we started reading on Tuesday night as well, is very, you know, it's just so amazing. And Derek, you know, you said we've already read some of it, so maybe we can skip some of it or just briefly recap some of it. But here's a quote that I'd like to read. It's from the foreword, actually. And it kind of speaks to the difficulty that the beings that we know as the Revelators, the beings that brought us this book, and we don't really know much about them. And if you don't read the book, you wouldn't know anything about them. If you read the book, you get to know who they are and what their role is in the universe of universes. Oftentimes, though, not anything personal like their name, their personal name, whereas sometimes we get that. But most often, we just get the order of being that they are and that they authored this particular paper or that particular paper. But this is from the foreword, and it says, "We are fully cognizant of the difficulties of our assignment. We recognize the impossibility of fully translating the language of the concepts of divinity and eternity into the symbols of the language of the finite concepts of the mortal mind. But we know that there dwells within the human mind a fragment of God, and that there sojourns with the human soul the Spirit of Truth. And we further know that these spirit forces conspire to enable material man to grasp the reality of spiritual values and to comprehend the philosophy of universe meanings. But even more certainly, we know that these spirits of the divine presence are able to assist man in the spiritual appropriation of all truth contributory to the enhancement of the ever-progressing reality of personal religious experience, God consciousness. They establish the ministry of that of those spirit forces in the foreword. Before we go too far, let us make this clear. We're counting on these spiritual forces in you to make this revelation accessible to you. I just love that.
It's awesome.
It's the ultimate comfort to me. You know, and going back to what we were talking about, the orphanhood that we often feel, like, you know, I remember as a kid thinking, gee, God talked to the olden men in the Bible. Why did he only talk to them? Why doesn't he still talk to us? That's, I remember having that thought as a child. Why isn't God still talking to us? And I think our problem often is the time frame involved. I'm reminded of Jesus saying to his apostles, I've come here to make a beginning of setting these things right, but many ages will be required to restore these parts of the universe back to their former paths. You know, and that's just back to the former paths. You know, so it's like that time is, in a sense, lost. That's a great quote from the foreword about the Spirit of Truth and the fragment of God that dwells within the human mind and how they work together to bring us, to lead us in truth. Andre?
You remind me of another important quote regarding that, and I'm rushing to dig it out, but it has to do with the nature of the Spirit of Truth generally. not just the fact that Michael gave us the Spirit of Truth, but the fact that every world eventually gets a bestowal son of the magisterial order, which is no less divine than Michael, just not a creator. That's, you know, and of the nature of the eternal Son and the infinite Spirit, rather than of the nature of the universal Father and the eternal Son. There's nothing inferior about that bestowal. What strikes me as well is that when Jesus was living here, he was living in full knowledge of the fact that he was not living only for this world, but for all other worlds in his local universe. And in that regard, it means that his Spirit of Truth is also designed not just for us, but for all other worlds, and leading all other worlds into that truth. Because one of the things that we're told about is that in the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth, the Spirit of Truth that is also bestowed by the Avonal Sons to a world after they have had a bestowal. But once the Master Son, the Creator Son, having lived seven bestowals and has now achieved sovereignty of his local universe.
And supremacy.
Once he, and supremacy. And we need to always, in this day and age, qualify that term, that it means he has the ability to see as the finite God of all creation can see. He has the fully combined view of the creator and the creature. That's what that term means. And by virtue of that, he then imbues all other spirits of truth with his bestowal Spirit of Truth.
Wow, that's wonderful.
In other words,
thank you.
They now take on that quality. When he bestowed the Spirit of Truth on this world, we can only wonder at how many other worlds that there had been bestowals. But let's say it could be on the order of another million worlds, even if it was only 100,000. It was somewhere between 100,000 and probably a million worlds or more. That bestowal Spirit imbued the Spirit of Truth that the Avonal Sons had bestowed on those worlds, so that on all of those worlds they would have noticed a slight difference. They would have noticed something other than what they had experienced before, and we can only wonder at that as well. And that's because Michael was trying to achieve that full view of supremacy, of the combined, blended, elevated, and perfected creator-creature viewpoint, which would allow him to have sovereignty. And he's the only being in this local universe that has achieved that. And they say, therefore, is he sovereign? I'll find that quote and put it out there.
Oh, yay, please do, you know, because that's a question that I always comes up for me. And my assumption has always been that they say on all flesh, so it is all flesh. But would you say then that those worlds that have not had a bestowal son yet probably don't benefit from it?
They can't benefit, but as soon as the next Avonal son, as soon as they receive a bestowal son, and as soon as they then receive a Spirit of Truth, it will be that joint Spirit of Truth.
Okay, cool. That's amazing. You know, I was struck by that quote I read too, that it says, but even more certainly we know that these spirits of the divine presence, and divine presence is capitalized. So, you know, they're saying that it's the divine presence, which I think is the omnipresence of God, or the conjoint actor. that is utilized as a conduit to bring all of this forth for all of creation, you know? It's the way the way in which these things happen. So yeah, when you find that okay, cool. Yeah.
It is paper 20, section 6, paragraph 8 begins at paragraph 9, gets to the kernel of it. And I'm putting it out there right now on the chat board.
Okay, read it to us too.
Oh, well, let me read it to you right now, yeah.
Okay.
And I'll put it out there in a moment. When the mortal incarnation is finished, the Avonal of Service proceeds to paradise, is accepted by the Universal Father, returns to the local universe of assignment, and is acknowledged by the Creator Son. Thereupon, the Bestowal Avonal and the Creator Son send their conjoint Spirit of Truth to function in the hearts of the mortal races dwelling on the Bestowal World. In the pre-sovereignty ages of a local universe, this is the joint spirit of both sons implemented by the creative spirit. It differs somewhat from the Spirit of Truth, which characterizes the local universe ages following a Michael's seventh bestowal.
There it is.
Upon the completion of a creator son's final bestowal, the Spirit of Truth previously sent into all Avonal bestowal worlds of that local universe changes in nature, becoming more literally the spirit of the sovereign Michael.
Mm.
This phenomenon takes place concurrently with the liberation of the Spirit of Truth for service on the Michael mortal bestowal planet. Thereafter, each world honored by a magisterial bestowal will receive the same spirit comforter from the sevenfold creator son, in association with that magisterial son, which it would have received had the local universe sovereign personally incarnated as its bestowal son. So you see, no world has been left out by the Michael bestowal. Mm. We are a favored world in the sense of Michael had his bestowal here, but in terms of the spiritual consequences, all other worlds benefit from Michael's bestowal.
Well, that explains why we're the shrine of all Nebadon, doesn't it? It really makes that crystal clear.
Yeah. And Marvin is back with us, by the way.
Yeah. Hi, Marvin. Welcome back.
Hi, folks. glad to rejoin you.
And thanks to our Bradenton, Florida listener who called back in. Glad to have you too, and our friends on the board. Were you going to say something,
Paul,
Marvin?
I wanted to pick up one theme, which is in the previous sections. If we're going to be reading the later sections in this paper, I think this is in section 2 of paper 194, and there were a couple of paragraphs related to how the Spirit of Truth functions in particular in service to our unique generation and in each unique generation, which is to me really fascinating. It really is pertinent to what you were saying, Paula, about the Lucifer Rebellion and the unusual situation we find ourselves in currently, in the current stage of planetary development, and kind of what we have coming up in the next while, you know, for the duration of the lifespan of this fifth epical revelation, you know, what its mission is. So here are the couple of paragraphs. They're 194, section 2. The first one is paragraph 6, and the next one is paragraph 1. Next, the Spirit of Truth came to help the believer to witness to the realities of Jesus' teaching and his life as he lived it in the flesh, and as he now again lives it anew and afresh in the individual believer of each passing generation of the Spirit-filled sons of God. And then carrying on in that theme even more pointedly, there's these fascinating statements. Jesus' message as he preached it and lived it in his day was an effective solvent for man's spiritual difficulties in that day of its statement. And now that he has personally left the world, he sends in his place a spirit of truth who is designed to live in man and for each new generation to restate the Jesus message so that every new group of mortals to appear upon the face of the earth shall have a new and up-to-date version of the gospel. Just such personal enlightenment and group guidance as will prove to be an effective solvent for man's ever new and varied spiritual difficulties.
I love that.
That's an amazing statement. You know, and so
yeah.
What they're saying is that, you know, the gospel needs to be represented so that it speaks more pointedly and relevantly to the needs and circumstances of each generation. And our times are incredibly challenging times, with dramatic developments in communication and travel, and making the world really a very much smaller place and a place where our differences collide and need to be reconciled in dramatically new ways. And so I think the need exists for a representation of the gospel, and the Spirit of Truth is there to help us. Jesus is there to help us to speak it anew in our lives and in what we share, so that it communicates well to the people who are hungry and searching in this time with its unique circumstances. It's a live, living representation. That's very striking to me.
Very much so. That struck me when we read it on Tuesday night in study group, you know, that very quote, that it is there for each generation, you know, adaptable. And I'm thinking about the problem that Derek posed right before we went off and came back on, and that was the woman that he met at the expo yesterday that was troubled by the word he in relationship to God or spirit. And how, you know, how unique our problems are in
well, you
this
know,
regard.
Paula, I want to just share one thought in relation to that. In the section on the nature of cultism, when they talk about the needs of the new kind of culture that's necessary to reach out to our times, to our culture, they use language very precisely, and they say a very interesting thing. They say this new and higher spiritual culture, and I think I've got the words almost precisely, it's section 87.7, must be predicated on the concept of the fatherhood of God and be pregnant with the mighty ideal of the brotherhood of man. They don't say must be based on the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. They parse the words to indicate that we need to adapt those underlying deep paradise realities to speak to our current generation. And so for me, the phrases, the spiritual parent-child relationship and the spiritual sister-brother relationship are ways of speaking to those underlying realities while respecting the needs of our generation to move to an understanding of family relationship that transcends gender. And while honoring the deeply parental nature of God, you know, recognizes that God has maternal and paternal qualities as the book portrays to us. And it's saying to us, speak to the current generation in a way that it can best assimilate. So I think we need to be creative as we adapt and move forward with the imperative to share the gospel for our day.
Good point.
Definitely when sharing the gospel, but it seems that the gospel and the Urantia book have a little bit different as far as like information present. So let's just take that one example dealing with that one woman at the expo. And she was triggered by the word he in relation to God. And I explained it kind of similar to what you were saying, Marvin. And while she might then identify and relate to what my personal philosophy is and how I see the Urantia Revelation's teachings working through me and how I view universe. Once she then takes that book and opens it up and reads all he, father, brotherhood, all that stuff, is just meeting me enough to counteract the potential triggers within the text. Yeah,
that's interesting. So it offers you an opportunity to adapt and upstep. Because mm-hmm. I think we have to keep in mind, as Merritt in his courses on New Rancho Book Perspective, this book came out of a culture of the 1930s. It's dated. You know, it's almost 100 years old. And the culture has evolved, and one of the key ways it's evolved is the understanding of the nature of the roles of men and women, and in understanding deity, is, you know, it affects that. So I think we have to take the text as it is and work with it creatively in adapting it and upstepping it with the help of the Spirit of Truth in ways that speak to people like this woman that you were describing, Derek. I think you were being creative. I think that's what you're saying, right, is that you start from the text as a springboard and then you improvise and work with it creatively as you minister.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, because it's backwards when you're introducing someone to the text for the first time, because they can identify with your personal philosophy of collective ideology, but then the deeper revelation is in the book that they're going to have to do. But when they go in there, there's going to be all sorts of triggering words for them, and I'm not going to be there to, to, you know, explain it always. So that's where it's interesting that community really does come in, where we have friends to kind of go over this stuff academically together. You know, if I didn't have study groups and teachers and mentors and stuff, I wouldn't have been able to grasp some of the really heady concepts in the Arantxa book.
And again, you know, there's a beautiful quote in the Arantxa book, and there's so many, obviously, but it makes me sad that somebody can't get past the word he. You know, I find it equally off-putting in my own personal experience when people refer to God as it, even though I know God is it. You know, God is she, God is he, God is all things, and omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, right? And we would assume that about God, but we don't have a word that represents that, that's representative of that. And I like Errol Strider's kind of humor. He told me once he's calling God hermit, the her, him, it. Because if he uses he, she, it doesn't come out so well. And, you know, he incorporates humor to show you that, you know, and then he goes on to call God the hermit, and it's cute and it's funny, you know, but still in the end you want to go back to some kind of personal name that makes God personal. And so, you know, that's where my heart is. And I don't have any problem with the word he, and I don't have any problem with father, because my father was wonderful, and he means so much to me. And so,
you know. Well, it's interesting, I think, about, you know, if you're just doing ministry or you're doing outreach or something, you're talking to someone at a booth, maybe you don't know why that person was called there. Maybe it was to get a Arantxa book. Maybe it was just to meet you.
Yeah,
and so
sure.
Maybe it's
exactly.
Kind of like the Spirit of Truth is this kind of like surrogate parent that can step in for the term father, right? So you could just kind of like, I find myself using the Spirit of Truth a lot as a term that kind of connects us all. Like I say, you know, the Spirit of Truth that works in all of us is kind of something that is a connective tissue in us as humanity, you know, that we're all family, we're all brothers and sisters because of divinity that's within us. And, you know, maybe that's just what that individual needed to hear at that time. Maybe the whole goal isn't for them to have the Arantxa revelation and all that, but just to understand that.
Yeah. Well, there you go, Derek. I think that's a very a positive way to look at it. And the quote that I was going to share that I think is so poignant is right from Jesus, what he told John Mark on the hillside that day when they spent the day alone in the hills together. He said, you know, as long as we teach the child to pray, our Father who is in heaven, a tremendous responsibility rests upon all earthly fathers, so to live and order their homes that the word Father becomes worthily enshrined in the minds and hearts of all growing children. You know, it hurts my heart that that isn't the case yet, but I don't think that's a permanent situation on this world. I think that someday that word will be as worthily enshrined in all the hearts of all growing children as it has been in mine, and as it has been in anybody who had a wonderful father figure in their life. You know, so I think that the revelators see us past these transient places, you know what I mean? These hiccups that we have that are unique to our world because of rebellion and isolation, but aren't permanent. And so they're looking forward to a time when there won't be these triggers and hot buttons for people. And certainly the spirit of truth, you know, I love that quote that Marvin shared about each generation, because the spirit of truth will get stronger in each generation as well. The more spiritual we become, the more conscious of God and goodness and truth and beauty and active in those areas we become, the more the spirit of truth will resonate, the more, the greater its work, the greater
its
ability.
Working.
Yeah.
With each generation, like a case in point, my aunt in Chicago, she's a divorce attorney, and she constantly reflects on how over the decades she sees more male involvement, father involvement of willing to pay the custody or pay the child support regularly and just make that investment to do what's necessary and responsible. When maybe previously there was a lot more abandonment and lack of morality and responsibility in whatever the custody issues are when there's divorce. So just that alone kind of tells me scientifically, just from observing, that, you know, there is a growth in parental involvement or truth involvement by males. Whether it's slow or not, it's still happening at some level.
It is, and I see it, like you, I see it in spades. I saw my own son-in-law take off 15 months from a highly lucrative job and lose a big chunk of pay to spend that 15 months with his little son, my little grandson. And it's all the benefit to them both. They have a wonderful relationship. Maxie just turned 3 on the 15th. And he has a wonderful relationship with his father, and his father has a wonderful relationship with him. And I see that happening more and more and more, and it does my heart good. It really does, because children need fathers, and the world needs a worthy concept of father, not just a punisher, not just a, you know, a worker and a person outside the home and a person that's disengaged and uninvolved. That's not worthy.
Just
you know, Paula, I think if we really look penetratingly at what's in the Rancher book about the nature of God, we have very, very serviceable concepts for God as Father and God as Mother, and I think we should work with those. I mean,
with
here
what
are just
we
a
have.
Couple, a couple of statements, and this is from the Paper 117, as God is your divine Father, so is the Supreme your divine Mother, in whom you are nurtured throughout your lives as universe creatures. And here's another one. The Maronchus soul of an evolving mortal is really the son of the adjuster action of the universal Father and the child of the cosmic reaction of the Supreme Being, the universal Mother. So I think if what we work with is that there's a way of relating to God as transcendent, as the other, and a dyadic relationship, and also there's a way of relating to God as the ground of our being, the common sum total of our relationships in spiritual family, That's the supreme. And the book equips us with both, and I think we should work creatively with both, even though the father concept is more emphasized in the book. The mother concept is very much there and available to draw upon.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find someone who, because of their family background or whatever other cultural influence, they're drawn to maybe more of the idea of God as a maternal presence, go for it, you know, build
mm-hmm.
that and grow it, you know, and, mm-hmm. and allow that to be honored and respected. And say, hey, it's some of both, and people at different stages are gonna really relate to different parts of God's nature, and have at it. You know, that's
yeah. enjoy.
We're all in process of growing. Enjoy it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
we're gonna cover all the ground eventually.
Right.
You know, so Jesus, that's what he did with the folks in Rome. You know, he really honored where they were, and then built from there. So I think we have the same opportunity with Jesus' help in the present time. And there's a lot in the book. There's a lot of stuff in the book we can work with creatively, like those passages about the supreme as our mother, as the ground of being, the evolving mm-hmm. ground of being.
Right, and that idea of nurturing all of your life, you know, eternally.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's powerful language. In whom you are nurtured throughout your lives as universe creatures, the
yeah.
supreme is our mother.
Yeah.
yeah. It's very powerful.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, our Bradenton listener would like to chime in here. I'm going to go ahead and put him on. Hi, you're with us on Blog Talk.
Yeah, hey, Paula. I got to admit, it's kind of a trigger for me. I mean, I definitely believe that there's a lot of truth. I mean, it's perhaps the truth. But I think it's a trigger for some reason. And, you know, I mean, Supreme Mother is still not God the Father. It doesn't seem like it's that difficult to think about God the Parent. That can go either way. And, of
right.
course, Jesus referring to, you know, our Father, his Father. That was certainly the whole world, except maybe a patriarchal tribe here and there on some continent. It was patriarchal. It certainly is culture, certainly the religion, and even currently. Women are getting 80 cents on the dollar. So
yeah.
I can appreciate the trigger that lady has, because it's a trigger I have, but there is truth in there. So I don't know, like to hear what you guys have. So I don't chime in much, because I'm kind of a novice compared to you experts.
Oh, no.
So I'll
well,
take
what,
your answer.
What's your
That's
name,
valid.
By the way?
Yeah, John Schreiner.
Oh, hi. Good to have you on. I'm so glad you
yeah.
you raised your hand. Yay. well
right,
hang
I'll
on
take
here.
I'll take the answer. All right. I will. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, you know, he brings up a good point. It's interesting, you know, and part of me was thinking that it just depends on what your goal is. Like, for this mm-hmm. particular instance, I was at an outreach booth. Like, the goal is kind of to get your answer book out in people's hands, right? And that, like, maybe it was materialistic and superficial for me, but I felt like there was two ways to get winning situations there, and that was one, to connect deeply spiritually with individuals, and the other was to maybe introduce them to the answer book so that they could get one and move on. And in that sense, it's a little bit different, because then you make the choice of, am I just connecting with this person? And then what we agree on in our little personal, immediate improv religion, is that going to reflect to the same terminology that's in the Urantia books, should this person decide to get a Urantia book?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
fully knowing that maybe the seeds planted might then foster the acceptance further down the road for the Urantia book too.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But then I also think about, like, on Manalantan and the Great Red Race, back in the day in America, he didn't call it the Father, he called it the Great Spirit, you know. And that's another term that I use sometimes with people. It's just depending on where they're at and who they are and what they identify with.
Right. Right. There would
Derek,
be no...
If you look at...
Go ahead, Marvin.
Go ahead, Paul. Well, if you look at how Jesus functioned, for him, the primary purpose in any interaction was his living and unfolding relationship with the person he was communicating with, sharing with right then and there. So I think your priority of, hey, here's a son or daughter of God, a sister or brother, and I'm here to relate to them, love them in the most intuitive, best way I can with Jesus' help, with the Spirit of Truth's help in the moment. And the book is simply a tool. And it's, you know, they'll associate the book with the power and love of their relationship with you in that interchange. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, when they wander away and move on, they'll have some exposure to the book. They'll have the memory of their interchange with you, but they've also got Jesus with them in the Spirit of Truth, kind of tickling their mind circuits and stimulating them along with their adjuster to pick up and move forward with whatever it is you could have shared with them. But I think the priority of the relationship first and foremost, and the book is simply a tool to help with their enlightenment, is exactly the right proportion. I think that's how Jesus would have approached it.
Yeah, that's important to think about, I think, Marvin, is how would he have approached that? And he would have been ultimately compassionate with our triggers because he knew so well what they were and why they were, you know.
He would probably also know that certain individual, what triggers that person in a positive manner as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
And spoke to that.
Right. And I've known many women who had tremendous issues with you know, whatever was going on in their early life. And they read the Arantia book, and it gave them that worthy father. And it actually facilitated a healing around that. You know, so that's valid too. I mean, you got to think of the other side of that. You know, whatever triggers you, oftentimes if you've done enough inner work, you know, oh well, that's my trigger. That's my my key to work on whatever my issue is. You know, that's in me. And so, why is that triggering me? And that's a way to do the inner work you need to do to heal around those issues, because you certainly can't go through life hating half of the planet, you know, or distrusting half of the planet.
Excellent point, Paula. Absolutely. That's their area of growth, you know, where they need healing.
Right, where they need healing.
Target.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and you being a therapist, Marvin, you know that. If they get triggered, that's what you got to work on. You know, there's the issue right there. That's what you get to
work
on.
Well, and, you know, Jesus was so sensitive to timing, you know, that you know, to help the person right where they were. And to give them little teasers and plant seeds for the growth that might come out ahead, but to minister to them exactly as they were. And I think that the lesson here is that the Spirit of Truth helps us with those same sensitivities and intuitions and skills if we call on Jesus to help us when we minister to people.
Beautiful.
You know, he equips us with some of the same sensitivities that he had.
I see that totally.
It's true.
The reason I think it's a trigger for me is because it's inaccurate. Bottom
line. Your spirit of truth is working in you and triggering you, is what you're saying.
Yes.
That's interesting.
I think that's valid too.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that causes a deeper inner work as well. You know, when you say, okay, what is it about, you know, I mean, being a woman in this world, I've dealt with that all my life. And I've come to grips with it on a very real level when religionists have told me that women weren't as good as men. I totally balked. And that also was the Spirit of Truth. I see that point completely. And I don't think, being who I am, I don't think I would have read the Urantia book if it hadn't exactly affirmed that women and men are equal, essential, equal in the truest sense of the word. You know, I mean, when I read that in that book, coming, you know, having been involved with a fundamental religion that said just the opposite, you know, and having wondered all my life with those rules and that inequality and that, you know, that certain kind of treatment that you get, that discrimination that's there, you know, even if it's not articulated, you feel it. When I read certain words in the Urantia book, tears of joy went down my face because I knew that wasn't right and that is not true. Women are not lesser than men. I've always known that. How can anybody be greater than the person that brought it onto the planet? You know?
Yeah.
The person
yeah.
that carried him and gave birth to him and brought him and nurtured his life and his beingness in this world. How can she be less than him?
I think, Paula, what you're getting at is that, you know, part of the healing process of the male-female challenge that we have on this planet, as the Urantia book tells us some of the history of that, and that, you know, women were the first slaves on this planet, and it was men who enslaved them. Part of that healing process of us working past that is a lot of that responsibility is on the man, right? It, like, yes, there's a great need for the empowerment of women, but there's also a great need of understanding, reflection, and reformation of masculine individuality as well, and
mm-hmm.
self-awareness. And until
mm-hmm.
us as men are willing to go in our inner world and do that self-work, there's going to be a overcompensation even, or a sense of guilt even about
mm-hmm.
the inequalities. But it's still a level of work that each individual needs to do. So I think that sometimes the sense of being triggered of things is also a trigger that's telling us that we have some self-work to do. We have some inner work to heal within ourselves, or that we see something near us that needs the transcendent healing quality of the spirit of truth, mind you. But this reconciliation that we all have to do, and especially us men, so that we can start to have reconciliation with women on an equal basis, spiritually and socially. But
yeah.
that still then doesn't negate the necessity for man and woman. Us healing ourselves and coming into good relationships with women as men does not negate the necessity for man and woman, neither, right?
Right. And women have to be open to that healing as well. And I take your point, John, so well, that sometimes a trigger is your outrage for an injustice. You know,
well,
something that's
think,
simply not fair. Go ahead,
and
Marvin.
I think to expand the frame of reference here, that the issues are even larger in our current world. It's not just man and woman. You know, our world is one where men and women's roles are evolving and colliding, and our relationships with
mm-hmm.
every other human being of every faith background, every racial background, every ethnic background, gender issues. And I think the gospel and the spirit of truth are speaking to our generation in a very particular and powerful way about the fundamental spiritual value of each individual mortal being, regardless of their gender identification, how they experience
mm-hmm.
themselves,
mm-hmm.
who they love, their race, their faith, their ethnicity, what country they were born in, regardless of any of those variables, each and every human being is a beloved son or daughter of God and enjoys equal status in God's
mm-hmm.
spiritual family. And when you put that out there and you hold that ideal high, you provide an
gospel.
Ideal. That's the gospel, and it's particularly needed in our day and generation
mm-hmm.
to help us deal with the exigencies of our world, where social factors, racial factors, national factors are colliding
gender
at an increasing rate. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's exactly our challenge. And so the fundamental truth of the gospel, that we are all equally beloved children of God and sisters and brothers to each other, is the ideal that will hold us through these very tense and difficult challenges
right.
on many fronts. Yeah.
And we pointed out in his appearances, in several of his appearances, he reiterated In the kingdom there is no Jew or Gentile, male or female, free or bond,
yeah.
young or
mm-hmm.
old. He really just, you know, if we take him at his word, then we're saying, okay, so if we're bringing the kingdom down, that those differences don't exist here either. It's what you just said, Marvin. We're all equally beloved. We all stand on equal footing spiritually, regardless of our apparent physical differences. Those are, you know, moot compared to our spiritual value.
Well, and you know, I think Derek asked about this upcoming thought leader forum on the higher symbolism of a higher civilization. You know, that is the peculiar challenge of our generation, and frankly, and the generations to come, is
mm-hmm.
as this world shrinks and moves through crises and forward movements, lurching, in a sense, toward lurching toward a situation where there's eventually a global government and peace and stability in the world, we've got to move through this whole transitional period, and it's critical that these higher ideals stabilize us and bring us a sense of coherence while we deal with the turbulence of this transition of the next 1,000 years. It's vital, really, for the gospel to prevail.
Mm. Well, let's read section 2, the significance of Pentecost. And at least we can read one section from this great paper, and then it'll give us a starting point next time as well. Who'd like to read that? Who'd like to read the significance of Pentecost? I can.
All right. Okay, I'll split it with you.
Either way. Sorry.
Yeah, go.
Everybody's muted.
Everybody's muted. Go ahead, Derek. Read it.
Okay, the significance of Pentecost. Jesus lived on earth and taught a gospel which redeemed man from the superstition that he was a child of the devil and elevated him to the dignity of a faith son of God. Jesus' message, as he preached it and lived it in his day, was an effective solvent for man's spiritual difficulties in that day of its statement. And now that he has personally left the world, he sends in his place his Spirit of Truth, who is designated to live in man and, for each new generation, to restate the Jesus message, so that every new group of mortals to appear upon the face of the earth shall have a new and up-to-date version of the gospel. Just such personal enlightenment and group guidance as will prove to be an effective solvent for man's ever new and varied spiritual difficulties. The first mission of the Spirit is, of course, to foster and personalize truth, for it is the comprehension of truth that constitutes the highest form of human liberty. Next, it is the purpose of the Spirit to destroy the believer's feeling of orphanhood. Jesus having been among men, all believers would experience a sense of loneliness had not the Spirit of Truth come to dwell in men's hearts. The bestowal of the Son's Spirit effectively prepared all normal men's minds for the subsequent universal bestowal of the Father's Spirit, the Adjuster, upon all mankind. In a certain sense, this Spirit of Truth is the Spirit of both the universal Father and the Creator Son. Do not make the mistake of expecting to become strongly intellectually conscious of the outpoured Spirit of Truth. The Spirit never creates a consciousness of himself, only a consciousness of Michael, the Son. From the beginning, Jesus taught that the Spirit would not speak of himself. The proof, therefore, of your fellowship with the Spirit of Truth is not to be found in your consciousness of this Spirit, but rather in your experience of enhanced fellowship with Michael. The Spirit also came to help men recall and understand the words of the Master, as well as to illuminate and reinterpret his life on earth. Next, the Spirit came to help the believer to witness to the realities of Jesus' teachings and his life as he lived it in the flesh, and as he now again lives it anew and afresh in the individual believer of each passing generation of the Spirit-filled sons of God. Thus, it appears that the Spirit of truth comes really to lead all believers into all truth, into the expanding knowledge of the experience of the living and growing spiritual consciousness of the reality of eternal and ascending sonship with God. Jesus lived a life which is a revelation of man, submitted to the Father's will, not an example for any man literally to attempt to follow. This life in the flesh, together with his death on the cross and subsequent resurrection, presently became a new gospel of the ransom which had thus been paid in order to purchase man back from the clutch of the evil one, from the condemnation of an offended God. Nevertheless, even though the gospel did become greatly distorted, it remains a fact that this new message about Jesus carried along with it many of the fundamental truths and teachings of his earlier gospel of the kingdom. And, sooner or later, these concealed truths of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men will emerge to effectively transform the civilization of all mankind. But these mistakes of the intellect in no way interfered with the believer's great progress in growth in spirit. In less than a month after the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth, the apostles made more individual spiritual progress than during their almost 4 years of personal and loving association with the Master. Neither did this substitution of the fact of the resurrection of Jesus for the saving gospel truth of sonship with God in any way interfere with the rapid spread of their teachings. On the contrary, this overshadowing of Jesus' message by the new teachings about his person and resurrection seemed greatly to facilitate the preaching of the good news. The term baptism of the Spirit, which came into such general use about this time, merely signified the conscious reception of this gift of the Spirit of Truth and the personal acknowledgement of this new spiritual power as an augmentation of all spiritual influences previously experienced by God-knowing souls. Since the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth, man is subject to the teaching and guidance of a threefold spirit endowment: the Spirit of the Father, the Thought Adjuster, the Spirit of the Son, the Spirit of Truth, the Spirit of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. In a way, mankind is subject to the double influence of the sevenfold appeal of the universe spirit influences. The early evolutionary races of mortals are subject to the progressive contact of the seven adjutant mind spirits of the local universe mother spirit. As man progresses upward in the scale of intelligence and spiritual perception, there eventually come to hover over him and dwell within him the seven higher spirit influences. And these seven spirits of the advancing worlds are: 1. The bestowed spirit of the universal Father, the Thought Adjusters; 2. The spirit presence of the eternal Son, the spirit gravity of the universe of universes, and the certain channel of all spirit communication; 3. The spirit presence of the infinite spirit, the universal spirit mind of all creation, the spiritual source of the intellectual kinship of all progressive intelligences; 4. The spirit of the universal Father and the Creator Son, the Spirit of Truth, generally regarded as the spirit of the universe Son; 5. The spirit of the infinite spirit and the universe mother spirit, the Holy Spirit, generally regarded as the spirit of the universe spirit; 6. The mind spirit of the universe mother spirit, the seven adjutant mind spirits of the local universe; 7. The spirit of the Father, Sons, and Spirit, the new name spirit of the ascending mortals of the realms, after the fusion of the mortal spirit-born soul with the paradise thought adjuster, and after the subsequent attainment of the divinity and glorification of the status of the paradise core of the finality. And so did the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth bring to the world and its peoples the last of the spirit endowment designed to aid in the ascending search for God. That's it. You get no more.
As if you didn't say enough right there. Oh, that section is just so great, and there's so much in it.
Yeah.
You know, so many things strike me. I mean, I can't help but notice the correlation between these seven and the seven combinations of the, you know, of deity, and how the combinations of deity exhaust themselves at seven. You know, so that's interesting to me, that, you know, these bestowals of spirit come in that same, you know, kind of pattern. And and I love this idea up here where it says, neither did the substitution of the fact of the resurrection of Jesus for the saving gospel truth of the sonship with God in any way interfere with the rapid spread of their teachings. You know, I love it when they show us the difference here between fact and truth, because there's so often confusion about that. You know, the fact that Jesus resurrected, yes, that is a fact. But there's a greater aspect to that, and that's the gospel truth of the sonship with God. And, you know, the other thing I got from this is, you know, what we've been talking about before, and that is that we will come to fully understand it. Once again, they've reiterated this concept many times, and that is that these truths that are locked up inside of these facts will come to the fore and will change our world. And they've said this several times in different ways, you know, that even though, you know, Christianity holds within it these truths, they're sleeping, they're dormant, but they will resurrect, and they will change our world. How does it say it? It says, and sooner or later, these concealed truths of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men will emerge to effectually transform the civilization of all mankind. Man, that's pretty powerful. When they tell us that Christianity is the cocoon in which the religion of Jesus lies dormant and sleeping, it's the same thing. It's the same concept. Jesus himself. Go ahead there.
Well, I mean, working on that, you know, you're talking about this kind of alluding to the growth of the emergence in the Christian church, so the emergent Christian community who are kind of more associating and identifying with the living Jesus and with the teachings of Jesus. And so that's, I can only imagine, a fertile playing ground for the spirit of truth to work.
Oh,
with,
boy.
You know? And so,
absolutely.
I'm looking at the term baptism of the spirit and how it came into general use around that time of Pentecost, and how it kind of signifies the conscious reception of the gift of the spirit of truth and this personal acknowledgement of this, you know, renewing. And I think, Marvin, you've found this quote a few times, and I can't find it right now, but where Jesus is talking to the apostles, kind of where he's saying, first your mind is renewed by the spirit of truth, something like that.
Yeah, it's in the lesson on self-mastery.
Right. Lesson on self-mastery. I have to find that quote. Andre,
I'll find it pretty quick. Go ahead, Derek.
But it's just, you know, it's interesting that, you know, this spirit of truth is this kind of refreshing gateway, this baptism, if you will, into spiritual consciousness. It's just so fitting that it's Jesus's antidote to, you know, that which can keep you isolated or separated from truth.
Mm.
I found the quote, if you want it.
Yeah, please.
So this is Jesus. He's saying, by the old way, you seek to suppress, obey, and conform to the rules of living. By the new way, you are first transformed, and they italicize the word transformed. By the new way, you are first transformed by the spirit of truth, and thereby strengthened in your inner soul by the constant spiritual renewing of your mind. And so are you endowed with the power of the certain and joyous performance of the gracious, acceptable, and perfect will of God. And then it goes on, forget not, it is your personal faith in the exceedingly great and precious promises of God that ensures your becoming partakers of the divine nature. Thus, by your faith and the Spirit's transformation, you become in reality the temples of God, and His Spirit actually dwells within you. So yeah, there's almost a formulaic sequence here, is that our minds are constantly renewed and uplifted by the Spirit of Truth, and that sets the stage for our being able to be open to the influence of the thought adjuster, and to be able to move increasingly toward the living out of the Father's will, of God's will in our lives.
I have a question about this. Marvin, maybe you can give me some insight. Is that while I'm sure there's a constant renewal and the baptism of the Spirit, of the refreshing powers of the Spirit of Truth, do you think that also this necessitates the need for a concept of reconciliation or confession type of thing, not in such like a ritualistic manner as the Catholic Church, but still this, I need to make right so that I can kind of have this opportunity to clear out for this renewal, this refreshing, this cleansing?
That's a good question. You know, Paula, you were talking about the difference between truth and fact, and the way that the Urantia book uniquely differentiates the two, and one of the ways they differentiate, I mean, speaking of the function of the Spirit of Truth and the constant renewal of our minds, they differentiate fact as something that is sort of a conceptual or ideational reality. It's something we understand with our minds, and it's sort of inert. You know, it's a thing, and it's a cognitive thing in a sense. Whereas a truth, they say the only way that truth can be apprehended is by living it. If something cannot be put into a living experiential expression, if we can't live it out, then it's not truth, it's fact. You know, so the fact that God indwells us is a fact. The living truth that we have, that interior relationship, is a feature of the unfolding relationship between us and the intimate indwelling presence of God. It's a living, unfolding reality, moment by moment, each moment. And so what they're saying is that this transformation by the Spirit of Truth in our minds is a constant ongoing phenomenon. So I don't think it depends on any ritual or particular act. It can, and those can help it, but it's, you know, it's an ineffable reality that's there all the time, that if we engage in it, it becomes a process factor for us. We're doing it in every moment. That's why the term, you know, constant spiritual renewing of our minds in each moment. So, you know, it's like opening a channel and participating in a flow of something.
And digging it deeper and wider all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
What you just said reminds me of that great wisdom from Paper 48. And it's just like the purest philosophy, I think, this paper just brings forth in so many ways. It's Marantia life in that paper. And so, you know, they talk about the ministering reserves and these other angels that minister to us and what they have to say in the Marantia life and the teachings of the Marantia life. And so this paragraph is one of those paragraphs where it just kind of like every sentence blows your mind. But it's from Paper 48, Section 633. It says, Lord's life, law is life itself and not the rules of its conduct. Evil is a transgression of law, not a violation of the rules of conduct pertaining to life, which is the law. Falsehood is not a matter of narration technique, but something premeditated as a perversion of truth. The creation of new pictures out of old facts, the restatement of parental life in the lives of offspring. These are the artistic triumphs, the shadow of a hair's turning, premeditated for an untrue purpose, the slightest twisting or perversion of that which is principle, These constitute falseness. But the fetish of factualized truth, fossilized truth, the iron band of so-called unchanging truth, holds one blindly in a closed circle of cold fact. One can be technically right as to fact and everlastingly wrong in the truth.
You know, the explication of that is so amazing in Jesus' life as he dealt with the scribes and Pharisees. I mean, he said that over and over to them. You know, you are great at the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, you're blind. You are blind teachers. And he was a teacher of this. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's over and over that theme pops up in his interaction with him.
That's a good point. And I think we reiterated a couple of times that the spirit of truth is leading us into all truth. And so that leading may take us through many factualized truths, many fossilized truths, many iron bands of so-called unchanging truth. We may for a time be blindly held in a cold circle of fact, like perhaps some secular scientists are right now.
You know, I think, Paula, there's something to be said for the, you know, for lack of a better term, negative object lessons. I think, you know, that passage you read is so on target. I don't know about any of you. I've had experiences where I've wandered away from that. And some of the deepest and most powerful spiritual lessons I've experienced are the times when I have failed to hold to that ideal, and then found my way back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are sources of real wisdom. They're very hard. So I think there's something to be said, you know, for all our listeners that, you know, when you fail, rise up in you know, and return and understand the errors. And as my friend Gar Jameson is fond of saying, repent, you know, come back to the path and see your way forward. And use it as a springboard to move forward even more effectively with the ministry of forgiveness and the ministry of the Spirit. So it can happen positively. It can happen in response to error and missing the path as well. But, you know, it's the living truth that really moves us forward.
Yes, and we follow it. If we faithfully follow it, where it leads.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not what we want to hear. And I wanted to also say, Derek, you know, to your question about being in the confessional, you know, I think it has power beyond a ritual, but only insofar as someone is being truthful to themselves, you know what I mean? To where they say they're not confessing so much to have somebody say, well, that's not so bad, you know. They're confessing to themselves the truth of their own errors.
Yeah.
So that they can change, so that they can identify them. You know, even seeking absolution probably isn't effective. What's effective is admitting to yourself, you know, that you've wronged something or someone, even yourself, and taking steps to correct that. I think there's the value in that. It's the admission of wrongdoing in, like you said, Marvin, repentance, you know. It's powerful
it's very powerful.
Yeah, to have that healthy of an inner life where you can admit to yourself your wrongdoing and do something about it. It resolve to change, resolve to do better, you know.
I think it only happens. Go ahead, so I'll try it, Paul.
No, I just said not that it's easy, but go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I think it really only genuinely happens in interaction with spiritual forces, you know, with an intimate relationship with the Father's presence within and guided by the Spirit of Truth and soul searching, heart searching, you know, and looking at the truth and allowing the Spirit to heal and move us forward. And that's, to me, the beauty of the lesson, that no matter how much we might wander, the Spirit and the Father's presence and Jesus are there to help us correct course and move forward. and grow as a result of our 3 steps forward, 2 steps back kind of path. You know, it's the human condition. We have to respect it and deal with it, and allow it to, in its positive and negative expressions, to help us move forward and grow. You know, and the spirit is there with us and for us in each of those exigencies. So it's not always a smooth path. You know, it's not always peaches and cream. I think there are times when it's rough and it's confusing. But if we're really hungry for truth and that's our allegiance, you know, we will move inexorably forward with the help of the Spirit.
And be grateful for that. You know, I think that's a key as well.
Mm-hmm.
To be grateful for the truth. I think Derek, you just read from section 2, the first mission of the Spirit is, of course, to foster and personalize truth. For it is the comprehension of truth that constitutes the highest form of human liberty. Isn't that a great statement? I mean, he said it in another way when he said, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Well, it's a really complex issue, though. As simple as it sounds, I think, a true liberty. Because I remember there was a point where, just in passing, they say, you know, Jesus had just finished giving a sermon or a discourse on true liberty under sonship of God, right? And in today's platform of society, that sounds heavily triggering, as to tell me that true liberty is to declare that I'm a child of something, right? That I'm not my own independent, isolated thing. Right? It's kind of like, here it is, it's like true liberty under sonship with God, or child of God, versus the Lucifer Manifesto, which is like liberty, equality of the mind, right?
True and false liberty, yeah.
There's
a great section in the book on that, true and false liberty. Yeah.
Well,
it
also,
is.
You know,
go ahead, Marvin.
Just briefly. Yeah, in our current society, I mean, I think the 12-step process captures that so well, is there is no order in our lives without a profound dependence upon the grace and constant guidance of God. You know, the idea that we can do our lives well all by ourselves is the Luciferian illusion. You know, it's just a totally false promise.
Right.
The only way we function well is profoundly independence and in interdependence with the Spirit, because it's only by God's grace that we do anything good. You know, we're good, we're loved, but the source of our goodness is the indwelling Spirit, and it's only insofar as we depend utterly on that presence and do our lives or live our lives with that presence that good things happen in our lives and we can manifest good things, you know. It's totally by God's grace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The deceptive part of that is that some people's nature has so much competence and talent. I'll maybe just focus on talent. That when that's part of somebody's nature, and that is the part of life that confronts their nature mostly. In other words, they fit, the lives that they're leading fit very well with the talents they have. They can be lulled into a false sense that there really isn't any need for anything like grace. And that seems to be where, you know, our dictum in the Arantia movement, the one that among a few others is quoted over and over again, the greatest affliction in the universe is never to have been afflicted.
Mm-hmm.
People that have either afflictions or don't have their nature matching up with their life circumstances very well, come to realize that they are insufficient for the human condition as we find it. And they either continue to move in that direction under a false illusion of continuing to fail, and either masking that to themselves or just being willing to do so, or they come to reckon with the fact that they do need grace, as Marvin pointed out, and that grace functions. The amazing thing about grace is that it functions as a gift in such a way that when it's received, it seems like it's part of your nature anyway. The only thing is, it isn't, because you don't get it until A, you receive reception capacity for it, and B, you ask for it, and particularly you ask God for it. And it's a very, very interesting feature of life. For those that have gone through 12-step programs and have experienced that, that's what they experience. All of a sudden, the quote is, they find God doing what they couldn't do for themselves.
Mm.
Or stated otherwise, all of a sudden, it seems like they don't have that problem anymore.
Mm.
Well, I just thought of something, an example from the life and teachings of Jesus, of him leading somebody from a fact to the truth. And I'd like to share this, if I could. This is from that marvelous section where he's traveling through the Mediterranean with Ganad and Ganad, and he's just doing good as he passes by. And it's his private ministry. The book tells us it's his private ministry versus his public ministry, which most of the world has through the Bible. But This is before he took up his public ministry, and so it's very dear to all of our hearts. And he says to the condemned criminal, "My brother, you have fallen on evil times. You lost your way. You became entangled in the meshes of crime. From talking to you, I well know you did not plan to do the thing which is about to cost you your temporal life." That's the fact right there. He's telling him, this is the fact. "But you did do this evil, and your fellows have adjudged you guilty. They have determined that you shall die. You or I may not deny the state this right of self-defense in the manner of its own choosing. There seems to be no way of humanly escaping the penalty of your wrongdoing. Your fellows must judge you by what you did. But here's the truth. But there is a judge to whom you may appeal for forgiveness, and who will judge you by your real motives and better intentions. You need not fear to meet the judgment of God if your repentance is genuine and your faith sincere." He's telling him the truth now. The fact that your error carries with it the death penalty imposed by man does not prejudice the chance of your soul to obtain justice and to enjoy mercy before the heavenly courts.
Amen.
Very nice.
That's how the truth sets you free, right? That's how it works. It sets you free because it's liberating. You know, I mean, I often pondered that, you know, Jesus saying that truth, you know truth by its liberating qualities, that truth will set you free, and then someone comes along and tells you, well, you're going to hell. Well, how is that setting me free? You know, now you're enslaving me. That must not be true. That must not be true, because Jesus told me the truth would set me free. So, you know, I mean, when someone comes along and tries to enslave you with so-called truth, that's the iron band of fossilized truth, right? It holds you forever blindly in a closed circle.
Oh. Yeah, that iron band of fact, well, we're experiencing a lot of it in a lot of the arguments that people get in over the internet over various things. They're really sharing perspectives on single aspects of situations which have very little to do with the livability of what is going on. You know, there are a lot of people justifying, for instance, mendacity in government as mm-hmm. being acceptable. And the long-term livability of that is quite questionable, especially in the quote that you just read, concerning the slightest twisting or perversion of that which is principle. These constitute
right.
falseness.
Right.
You know, it's not a matter. What is your motive? What are you trying to do? Makes a big difference in what you're doing. But it also is important that you choose good means for achieving good ends.
Right.
But we might be surprised as to how broad that is. I don't think that it allows for certain things like premeditated falseness. I don't know that that's allowed as a means of getting to the truth.
Hmm.
Other than those that fall into that sin will eventually be shown the truth if they have any openness to it whatsoever.
And maybe they already know it, and so they're actually utilizing that compelling nature of truth to add a falseness onto it and get it through. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a way to bootleg falseness. You just glom it onto a little bit of truth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well,
that
is a pernicious kind of lie, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one that
yeah.
contains some truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much we could go to here, but just speaking generally, you know, one of the lines in the Arendt book is that pride, you know, that pride is the greatest sin, and pride goes before a fall. And I think when there's distortion of truth, you know, you can chalk it up to error, but if it's premeditated and intentional, then it's sin. In other words, if you know that you are lying and you persist in it, and you persist in it over and over and over, you know, the book says you have an iniquitous situation. And that's mm-hmm. That's a disaster waiting to happen. You know, so you know, wherever we see it in life, you know, it's a disaster waiting to happen. Not pretty.
And that's where the spirit of truth really is invaluable, to lead you through those,
mm-hmm.
right? And past those and around them.
Mm-hmm.
And help you identify them and see them for what they are. If you embrace it and incorporate it, to help you miss those disasters, you know, step aside from that pitfall.
You know, and
well,
the opposite of,
go ahead, Mark, I'll give you the last word.
The opposite of pride is you know, an understanding of how profoundly dependent we are on the spirit within for
yeah.
to do anything right. I found one of my favorite quotes in that regard. It's the consciousness of a victorious human life on earth is born of that creature faith which dares to challenge each recurring episode of existence. When confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations, by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it, a part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And that is, quote, the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith, unquote.
I love that
quote.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's one of
paper.
My favorites. I can't tell you how many times in difficult situations that quote comes to me. Even though I may not be able to do this, there's one who lives
yeah.
within me who can and will do it.
Yeah. When confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations, I mean, that's
right.
such a classic.
It's a classic.
That's paper, paper 4, section 4, paragraph 9, if anyone wants it. It's a great passage.
Well, friends, we're going to leave it with that because that one was such a beautiful way to end this show. And we'll be back next week talking more about the Spirit of Truth. And we hope that you will join the Christ Experiment in their Remembrance Supper on the 6th. Everybody's invited after sundown to do a remembrance. Hey, we love you. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week. Thanks, Marvin and John. Really appreciated your input. You're always welcome back to call. Love it when you call. And thanks to our listeners.
Always a pleasure, Paula.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye, you guys. God bless.
Until next time, bye for now. Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for bearing with all of our technical difficulties today. Really appreciate it. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.